Joe, how you doing?
Just another perfect night, Tim, and there's no fires anywhere in sight.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, yeah, here it's very cold, very seasonal. I don't mind it. It's winter, and I'm becoming in the mood for it. Of course, we're in the final days of 2017, and we're going to go back in time some, well, I guess it would be at least 38 years, but really 40, 45 years into the 1970s. We'll talk about the 1970s sort of as a hangover from the 1960s. Feminism came of age, disco music, stagflation, the rise of the neocons, pet rocks, lava lamps, and leisure suits. So the 1970s, Joe, those 1970s were your salad days, I presume, right? That was your time, right?
I'm still waiting for my salad days. Okay. I was alive. I did, as everyone did, get swept up in some of it. Mm-hmm. Things that I would be embarrassed about today. But it was just in a really kind of an important time to study because, I think it's well established that we had a organization and an operation that diverted American, particularly white European American culture in the 60s. Okay, it you can trace it way, way back, but you can certainly start this with in 1957, May, with Gordon Wasson, and then in the 60s, you had all of the government operatives in motion to create, the counterculture. Ends up with, Woodstock and Altamont. Kids fornicating in the mud, there's just a tremendous amount of drug use, and they have an archaic revival appearance to the young people. They have kind of quasi-American Indian and Pirates of the Caribbean look, and also just the hobo. I mean, these things are all kind of blended together into the hippie. This all comes to an end. You have Woodstock and then Altamont. And so now you have the 70s. And amazingly, you have, a new phenomena that kind of grows to some extent out of the counterculture. And it's the disco movement. And it's really hard to even, characterize how widespread this phenomena was in the 70s if you didn't live through it, but it was very widely promoted. I would say that the disco, as far as a media phenomena, was more promoted than the hippie was. So I think it should be studied in that regard, and we'll do that tonight. But the 70s were also an enormous sea change in terms of the middle class. This is when all the demographics go south. Everything goes wrong for the middle class. Starts slowly, but it all starts in the 70s. You start having the increase in single moms. You start having less family production. The wage earner is starting to get pinched, right? This is where you start seeing the two parent income rather than stay-at-home mom. So for some reason, America started to change dramatically at this point. And you also started to see the advent of pornography, right? You started to see Playboy magazine, Hustler magazine, Penthouse magazine. They were almost everywhere. They started to become ubiquitous. It started to normalize it. So the culture shifted in a bad direction. And so to help with the schematic, of how we got from the MK Ultra production of the counterculture to where we are today with the debased, integrated, non-family producing pornographic culture, you got to understand how the transition occurred. It's important to try to see if it was deliberate. This would be very useful in terms of what you and I have described as the building out of the schematic. So Tim, what events in the 70s, stood out to you as things that, people should be aware of?
Well, looking back, I think one of the major events, you mentioned the pinching of the middle class, decline of the family, the advent of the two-income family, the working mother. And, of course, going into the 1970s, there was still a large gap between male and female income. I think it was 40 cents on the dollar as the decade opened. And contrary to popular belief, I don't believe the narrowing of the gap is a sign of progress, because that was all with the rise of women's income to now, I think, close to 80% of male income on average is actually a negative index, a measurement, rather. It's because it shows that women have been forced into wage slavery, and they call it freedom. And this has also had a deplorable effect on the quality of family life, and that much less resources are devoted into the nurturing and raising of children and the providing of a sort of a decent domestic abode for the family, particularly for the male. So it's had a deplorable effect disguised as progress. The oligarchs have done a wonderful job of disguising slavery as freedom, and that's how get people to accept it. And it goes back to the policies that were decisions that were taken, and not just because the politicians were foolish or short-sighted. That's the excuse. As you enter 1970, the U.S. economy was in a recession. Nixon, it was understood Nixon kind of panicked, and that's when he closed the gold window, because for the first time the U.S. economy went into a trade deficit. And when they closed the gold window, that cut the dollar's last tie to gold and the discipline associated with the Bretton Woods system. That was a consequence of the guns and butter policy of the 1960s, sort of the spend, and the promises of the Bretton Woods system. The U.S. dollar could no longer be redeemed in gold anymore, because there's simply too many dollars out there floating around. So you just simply say, close the gold window, shut the Bretton Woods system down. By the way, it's supposed to be a temporary measure. Here we are, 47 years later. He imposed a bunch of wage and price controls, which are just nonsense, caused a lot of havoc. Of course, in 1973, you had the Yom Kippur War, which some people believe, and I think there's a lot of evidence to the effect that it was sort of fomented by Kissinger as a pretext for creating the petrodollar. And that was to cause an oil shock to cause the price of oil to increase 400%. At the same time, they're working out the deal with the Saudis to sell their oil only in U.S. dollars. This creates huge demand for U.S. dollars, creates a vast pool of credit for the federal government and treasuries. A lot of that money gets siphoned back into U.S. banks and these things, and also makes many oil projects profitable overnight. One thing is the North Sea oil project, and also the Alaskan pipeline deal and these things. And I think it was the researcher, financial writer F. William Engdahl, who's written a lot about that, and he actually has the documents from Bilderberg in the meeting in, I think, in May of 72, when the decision to foment a war was taken. And that's what we call the Yom Kippur War, and that's when everyone started hating Arabs for oil. So this brings on the oil shocks and the stagflation in the 1970s. And at the same time that, of course, that they ushered in the era of inflation, the banks are kind enough to issue in the era of the credit card. So what they take away in debasement, they give for you in credit, compound interest, of course. And that's why. And that's also when, you said, wages stagnated, and they've never recovered since then for the working man. This had a profound cultural effect on society, cultural effect, because the two-income family gave would sort of present an illusion of prosperity, of high income, because you have more income coming in, and it changes consumption patterns, things like that, because no longer you're earning to get by, you're earning to consume, and you're buying things. You're not building savings, you're not building equity, and you're going into debt to consume, and this goes a long way towards creating this debt-based consumer society, which corporate America and the banks wanted. And, it changed people's expectations of what was normal. And you saw this. This also coincides with the sort of the coming of age of the feminist movement. It had its origins in the late 50s and early 60s with Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, but really came of age in the 1970s. And that's when pop culture picked it up, and you saw it being portrayed on television. You had this idea of the battle of the sexes. You had this fixed tennis match between Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King.
Yeah.
you know, where she defeats him. It turns out it was most likely fixed. Bobby Riggs made the ridiculous claim that any man could beat any woman. That's an absurd claim, but it turns out that that was just there. It was a, you know, surprise, surprise. It was a publicity stunt. Nevertheless, this war of the sexes thing. It's that was, you know, all this nonsense in the 1970s, and it had, you know, this profound effect. Of course, 1973, you have the legalization of abortion by the Supreme Court, and this obviously goes towards depopulation, war, to decline birth, you know, attempt to decline to lower the birth rate, and that also coincides with the sexual revolution, sort of its second phase in the 1970s, because you mentioned that in the 60s you got the counterculture movement, and you had the spreading, you mentioned the sort of normalization of pornography in the 1970s. Of course, that's, I think, Deep Throat was put into a mainstream theater, and that was a big, I think it was 1971 or something. So, yeah, so profound effect. The 70s, one of the things that interests me about the 70s, because you were still, if you were observant, you could still see remnants of sort of the older culture. People still kind of expecting it. But by the end of the decade of the 1980s, it had been washed away. And, you know, so that's my observation. I experienced as a child, but I do experience gas lines, and these things were created because there wasn't any shortage of gasoline. But I remember waiting in gas lines. I remember whip inflation now buttons under the Ford administration. That's his plan to fight inflation, was to just wear buttons. And, so
what I saw, you know, those things are all, I want to talk, just like elaborate on a few of the points you made. I mean, the first is that, the generation gap that had begun in the 60s, which was created obviously by the counterculture operation, it continued because the disco movement became such a powerful media phenomenon. It actually drove the fashion of the young people. And so you can see that there was really... you know, I believe that disco was basically just part of the operation. It was just the next phase. And even though it was completely different in its costuming, it was still a very distinct, you know, bifurcation from the clothing that middle-class people wore. The kind of clothes that the disco kids would wear was very outrageous and distinct. And so It helped to take the baby boomer, you know, away from the cultural influences of the family that mm-hmm. it produced, and then prepare him for, you know, basically the neo-American existence, where you don't have families. The males basically will, you know, spend time as, you know, kind of sexual predators. And the women, if they have children, are out of wedlock, and the government, you know, supports both sides. The movie Saturday Night Fever, even though it's kind of, you know, characterized as almost, you know, a heroic, you know, tribute to this young man's struggle for independence. If you look at it in the right perspective, you can see it's just cultural pornography. You know, the kind of sexual hookups that were going on, you know, in the film, and mm-hmm. Just a casual attitude toward drugs and alcohol, the very, you know, kind of the outrageous clothing, and really in the discotheque, what you really saw were two phenomena that had been touched upon in the 60s, but really weren't you know, developed to any extent, and those are integration and gay and lesbian kind of lifestyles.
Mm-hmm.
The disco started really as a, you know, a gay dance movement, and you know, if you had been in these clubs in say Marina Del Rey in Los Angeles in the 70s, you could see that They were highly integrated. There were lots of black, people there, and they were dancing. They were kind of heroized as great dancers. But there were also a tremendous amount of gay people. Gay people started to, this is where they would be if they were going to be in integrated culture. This is where they would be. A lot of the original dance clubs were basically gay bars, and they were separate. There was a well-known guy, David Mascuso, I think his name. He had a club in New York, and this sort of became the prototype for like Studio. I'm drawing blanks, like Studio 51.
54, yeah.
54, right. Mm. And so now in those places, they were famous for risque sex, these clubs. In San Francisco, you had a transition from the youth culture basically into the disco scene, which was kind of a quasi-gay bathhouse dance scene. And, then at the end of the 70s, in the 80s, you had the so-called HIV epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And when they went in to study that, because they needed for, pandemic control, they wanted to get some statistics. I got a chance to look at the studies that were done, and this really shows you kind of the cultural direction that we had come from, like the 50s to this present time, in the early 80s, so that you could reflect on what happened in the 70s. In the study they did, they had a median for the groups they were studying. And that number was 300 sex partners a year. So in other words, they had half of the people they were studying, and these were individuals who had either had HIV supposedly or were very vulnerable to getting it. They had 300 was the median sex partner. So this is really, degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just out and out degeneracy. And it was manifesting not just in HIV, but it, as you can imagine, in every other sexual transmitted disease imaginable. Now, HIV appears to have been a fraud because they claimed it was going to break out into the heterosexual community and it was all going to, wipe out mankind. This never happened. But the transmission of sexually contracted diseases, has been on the increase ever since then. So you can see that we went through this sexual transition, right, in the 70s. And it was then you mm-hmm. could see it. You had the gay lifestyle. E. Michael Jones talks about America being a gay disco, right? He uses that as a, not as a term of endearment, but that's a nation that has a moral degeneracy to it. And the gay disco is really, just from these statistics, is really a, an incredible focus of degeneracy, right?
It's almost like you're just spinning around and around direction with no progress.
The
music's like that, yeah.
Exactly, you know, and there's no moral order to it at all, and the hookups, the sexual hookups are basically every night. I mean, if you have like 600 sex partners a year, I mean, that seems to me to be like a full-time job.
Yeah, you mentioned Saturday Night Fever. What I remember from that movie, I just remember John Travolta character, his home life. His father was an emasculated male, unemployed, bitter man.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of, because this is how the economic conditions of the 70s there to ruin the male authority, to weaken the wage earner. And he has weakened authority in the home because he's unemployed, and John has to go out and help family make ends meet by working at the local hardware store or something.
Yeah, paint store.
And he wants an advance to get an outfit so he can dance in it.
But the key to that movie, the thing that really shows you the kind of the mind control that's being exercised here, is that the really important character to me is Travolta's brother, who was a Catholic priest who basically was turning in, his priestly vows.
Yeah.
He had a crisis of faith, and he says, I don't really want to do this anymore. And then he goes and watches John Travolta dance on the dance floor and thinks this is terrific. Like, maybe this is where I should head instead of, you know. So this was, you know, I mean, and the guy who wrote it, I forget his name, but he was the Jewish guy, you know, making a comment on Italian culture, Italian Catholic culture. Mm-hmm. That was very, you know, damaging and in itself. And also, you know, I really would like to know, you know, how he got these images, where they came from, because, you know, I think they're you know, they were sort of true. I mean, there were Italian guys. You could see, like, the John Travolta character really was, you know, that's not something out of outer space. And there were Catholic priests kind of having crises of faith during this period. But you just wonder why these elements were selected to make a movie out of, you know, you know, when you look at the background of disco, I can't really trace it into, like, Freemasonry. I have a hard time doing that. Normally I can see connections that the Masons are involved in some way, but I can't really find it in disco. But you know what I really see are, first of all, lots and lots of black people, because it does, to some extent, come from a lot of their music. Mm-hmm. Then you see just tons of Jewish people. They're everywhere inside the creation of the disco, from Fran Lebowitz, whatever her name is, the journalist, to the guys who created the Village People.
It's very similar to jazz.
Like 54, Studio 54. And you wonder, what in the heck's going on here? You know, appeals to them about this cultural phenomena, because, you know, I don't know, the Jewish guys I know couldn't dance at all.
It's similar to the jazz scene, isn't it? From the 20s.
Yeah, it's very similar. You know, you know, I suspect a conspiracy, Tim. Do you know why? Because I just can't imagine anything other than a conspiracy getting white guys on a dance floor.
Yeah.
I mean, what the heck is going on? This is not our normal thing. One of the great moments in the rebellion from, you know, like, modern culture for white guys is to walk away from, you know, the dance world. It's just not our normal thing.
No, it's just not. Yeah, just not.
Just isn't us, you know. And so if we're in that world, we're being pulled in, and it isn't, we're never going to succeed in that world. So get the hell out of it.
We're being put in a situation where we're inevitably going to be made fun of.
Exactly.
And they do. White guys can't dance. Yeah. And, of course, there's the reaction to this disco. Of course, the disco sucks movement, if you recall. I mean, that was very...
Sure, of course.
And that was... and I guess it culminated, I think, in the summer of 79, because it's kind of funny, because disco was already fizzling out. So, you know, pop culture is always behind the curve a little bit. In Comiskey Park, I think, in Chicago, some local DJ blew up 1,000 disco records before a baseball game, or after a baseball game, or something, as a protest.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is that if you looked at sort of how the people involved in it, how they characterize it, they basically said is that, look, you know, we're opposed to you know, homosexual and black culture. Mm-hmm. This is actually what they said. I don't have any quotes in front of me to that effect, but I can remember. I could find them if people want me to find them. They was very clear that was really what they're about, and they were saying, now it's not racism. We don't hate you. We just don't want to, like, be like in a situation where their culture is basically something that, you know, is being promoted. It's like they could see the people in Comiskey Park who rioted. Just kind of, I think, emotionally understood that what was going on wasn't just, you know, a fad, but was actually something that was dangerous to their culture. Mm-hmm. So that's how I looked at it. I, you know, I'm sure, you know, it varies from person to person, and there's no question that, you know, you can find individuals who had a bad place in their heart. You know, nevertheless, you know, it, I think, okay, so I have a quote here. There was this guy, now he's not really sort of, you know, I'm thinking about more of the Comiskey Park guys, but there was guys who wrote that, you know, he says, you know, disco was a result of an unholy union between homosexuals and blacks, right? and that was Legs McNeil.
It's interesting, yeah, interesting, yeah.
And but you see that, okay, so that is probably a kind of a cultural symptom, you know, that the individual is not really thinking deeply about this, but he just senses that there is a, you know, something happening to basically European culture in America. And why is this going on? You know, this is where you have to spend more time in research, Tim, is that I just don't think these things are happening spontaneously. I don't think that, you know, white European guys are deciding to wear polyester pants and dance to Boogie Fever in these nightclubs spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that culture is being dragged into this direction. And I think basically the boomer, the baby boomer, this the largest demographic fraction, you know, the one that they really wanted to change culturally, I think they're being targeted. You know, you had the Vietnam War and the counterculture in the 60s. And then you have basically the onset of integration, homosexuality, right? These cultures, and of course feminism. Okay, so that was that component of it. And I also just wanted to mention that, you know, you talk about the statistics of feminism, and it just shows you how statistics are slippery. I don't know if you ever saw Thomas Sowell, the black economist, argue a feminist. It's a famous YouTube video, and he points out that the inequality in wage earning between men and women is actually untrue. It's just a question of how you frame the statistics. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at women who had the same education level and who had unbroken careers, right? Mm-hmm. Then the wages would become almost, you know, at par between the two groups. It was when you started to make these changes in lifestyle activity because of the woman being involved in family life that then you started having these big changes. But you see, and I've never seen this done, but I think it would be a great statistical project to do, is the parity that men and women are achieving is all achieved, therefore, based on the information that Sowell was presenting, by the destruction of things that are beneficial to the lives of mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
The two are completely related. In other words, you get, if you take away X amount of time from with children, you would, on the other end, you would have closer to parity. If you have a larger fraction of women without husbands, then you would have another increment moving toward parity. All of the things that move toward parity, by necessity, destroy the stay-at-home mom integrated, you know, family. So that's why the whole function of feminism, as it's been, you know, created as an economic thing since Gloria Steinem, has just been nothing but a weapon against the family.
Yeah, it's to if you measure femininity by masculine standards, it's like anything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah,
and so it's like anything is feminine. The irony is it's feminism, but they insult or they assault everything that is genuinely feminine because it's just, you know, they don't. Ideologically, they don't acknowledge the legitimacy of differences, the complementary differences between the sexes. And it is, there's an index there. It's almost like the popsicle index of Catherine Austin Fitz, where she correlates the growth of the Dow Jones Industrial Average with the decline of the quality of life in neighborhoods. And there's a connection there. And I don't think it's just coincidental. Yeah, because, you know, obviously, well, if you control for lifestyle choices and workforce participation, men and women's incomes are roughly the same. It's just that women, when they get married, work less and they devote more home. Even now, when they have children, they devote more time to family to domestic concerns than the man does. Men's income actually increases when he gets married. Women's income drops, and it's not oppression. It's because they are simply making choices in their own lives based on their own preferences and what they think is best for their family, and that drives feminism or feminists insane. So they pull out this very crude statistic comparing apples to oranges are very different. You know, men and women have very different workforce participation and different phases in their life. So you cannot Thomas Sowell did a good job of pointing that out. You cannot compare the two without addressing these details or distinctions or that are behind these statistics. Men and women participate differently in the workforce, so you can't.
Exactly. And if you drop out, if your career is not contiguous, if you drop out for a couple years to focus completely on children, mm-hmm. then you have a different economic perspective from the from an employer. If you go straight through from the time you're 24 to when you retire at 65, your trajectory is just different than someone that drops out for 2 years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's employers look at that. So the fact that women had that as something that was likely to happen to them, that was something that was completely desirable. That was completely necessary for culture.
Yeah, you mentioned my interview with E. Michael Jones, the link between feminism and obesity.
I know.
And it makes sense if you think about it. Yeah, because people are now eating processed food, junk food, fast food. They don't have the benefit of someone cooking from scratch, from healthy, taking time to prepare a healthy meal. And that has long-term, widespread effects on the quality of life. That means the value of someone at home, just organizing the home, taking care of it, and that being denigrated as being, I'm not going to be a 1950s mother. I'm not a Ward, I'm not a June Cleaver. Thing and these things, as if that's the that's the choice we have, as if that was reality.
Exactly, it's just a fake choice.
So if you're not going to have someone at home, and they're at work, that's going to be a lot of things aren't going to get done. One thing is a meal, and you're going to
eat. Well, and also you're depressed all the time because you're living alone. Mm-hmm. So you want nothing but comfort food. And since you're a single person, usually with some support from the government, you can't really afford decent food. So you're just going to have junk food and ice cream. Mm-hmm. And, you'll weigh 400 pounds when you're 50 and die of diabetes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a life that, this style of life is not defensible. It's not healthy.
Yeah.
And so the 70s is really, that decade, you could see that the boomer had been drugged out, given mysticism, and the values of archaic culture, and it was all set for the disco.
Well, I mean, if you're looking at a conspiracy, if you want high-level malevolence, we do get some of that in the 70s with the Stanford Research Institute's The Changing Images of Man,
right?
Where they talk about that very thing, promoting mysticism, doing away with industrial society, because that goes in line with the macroeconomic policies. Is one thing when they enthroned the petrodollar, what it did was it created the macro environment where the U.S. would be gradually deindustrialized, because what it did was it made the dollar artificially strong, which makes U.S. exports more expensive, but also makes imports cheaper. So what happens is eventually it no longer becomes economically viable to have factories in the United States because it's cheaper to produce them because of the overvalued dollar, because you can buy more with the dollar. So instead of producing goods and, in a sense, using those goods to buy, to trade with other goods, which we do with dollars, when you have this overinflated dollar, you can just produce paper and inflate to bring in the imports. But it results in your deindustrialization and the over-financialization of your economy, which, of course, both Great Britain and the United States experienced at different times because you have an overvalued currency. But this is also – the funny thing is this also has a broad cultural effect, which coincides with the agenda spelled out in The Changing Images of Man. It's hard to believe there isn't some coordination going along there. And you also, I think in 75 or 76, you had this Rambouillet conference where they decided that, in this case it was Germany, that Germany was going to outsource its very profitable and efficient textile operations to cheap third world labor. And at the same time, you have Kissinger with National Security Study Memorandum 200 devising this Malthusian plan to starve and drown the third world in debt with high energy prices and destabilize it. And this is also creating the conditions in the third world, which a generation later would produce cheap labor. it's, you know.
Right, right, right. Well, you see, it's interesting in that, the SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, Willis Harriman was the director of it. He was an MK Ultra participant, right? And so, there you have both the future of culture and then also the nefarious and secret government experiments into mind control. SRI was caught using these low-frequency experimental techniques on human beings, which was completely, it was against actually the Geneva Convention. That's how illegal it was. When the Navy found out about it, they put the kibosh on it, and then Harriman arranged to have funding come in through a secret source. He actually circumvented a direct order by the, you know, from the commander of the Navy, presumably. And at SRI was Nevitt Stanford, right, working with Willis Harriman. Now, Nevitt, amazingly, had worked on the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality. It was one of the signatures, one of the six signatures of it, or I think maybe more, but certainly I can think of six. And so, you know, when you see all these connections, man, it just seems hard to believe that this isn't organized. And in fact, that is, not.
Of course, wasn't Margaret Mead also connected to the Changing Images of Man?
Sure.
And so that, of course, her husband, Gregory Bateson, and the CIA, these things, yeah. And, and of course, you mentioned the authoritarian personality, which one of the agenda was to promote over-sexualization. And, of course, you get that. One of the, at least one of the consequences of that, you could say, would be the gradual mainstreaming and promotion of gay rights, gay culture, and disco music. Yeah.
Right, and see, that's why it's really important when you think of the American Jewish Committee's promotion of the authoritarian personality, and you look at what they're saying in chapter 23, where they're outlining the future, and they talk about how Eros is going to be used, and it's going to be propaganda. It's going to transcend normal psychological techniques. It's going to be done on a mass scale. Well, what in the heck are they talking about? It's easy to understand because you can see the concept reused by Herbert Marcuse, who was in this group. He was, from he had been with Adorno and Horkheimer in the organization that they had before the committee had hired them, and with Marcuse, you've got a real clear in Eros and Civilization. You've got the term used, and now you can see that he's talking about polysexualism. This was really the first time I think that homosexuality as a lifestyle was being promoted to the baby boomer. It didn't happen so much in the 60s, but when you had Marcuse's book become so popular, Eros and Civilization, that was really when you started to see the plan that was laid out, by the conclusion of the authoritarian personality. You could see it start to get into the 70s,
And you had the sort of the mythos around the Stonewall riots.
Exactly. Yeah.
This bar that was broken up, of course, it was a center for human trafficking, drug trafficking, and the cops came and busted it up, and it was a gay bar, and there's, some, I guess, head knocking and some violence and these things, and a riot broke out, and that's sort of how they piggybacked on the civil rights meme. The cops were like Bull Connor, and the homosexuals were like blacks. And the gay rights, this gay rights thing became the new civil rights movement, promoted by organized Jewish organizations. The connection is there. It's very interesting. And then, we hear about, now it's been sort of mythologized, the Stonewall riots and these things as they're coming out. And then,
yeah, it's fascinating because, see, I really think that when you talk about the Stonewall riots, okay, so, well, were they created, or Was it just that the pressure on the media to focus on things that, you know, the few who were inside the plan wanted to be represented? If that was that really how it was done? Mm-hmm. And I tend to you know, guess to the latter, because I haven't seen any evidence of the former. I think that, you know, they wanted to sexualize and polysexualize culture. And so when you had when the Stonewall riots occurred, they were just promoted far beyond any kind of legitimate news story that they might have, you know, represented. Mm-hmm. It was just, they were, these stories were everywhere, you know. And so this is how I think it was being done. I think that, you know, you look at like Saturday Night Fever, the movie, you look at, you know, how the music on FM was changed from, you know, kind of acid rock, and suddenly started having all of the dance music, you know, become very, very, you know, played very often. These are the ways that culture can be shaped. You don't necessarily have to have, you know, a plan for something like as specific as Woodstock. You can just shape it by making sure that the things that promote the perspective that you want to have, you know, manifested, that these things are what gets the publicity. And then that this is particularly the case when you've already set in motion, you know, kind of the as in terms of polysexualism, when you've already got, you know, the archaic revival values and Woodstock and, you know, everyone is kind of a child of God sort of perspective. There's no cultural dimensions or structures or limitations and taboos. Here comes discotheque. And who's to say, you know, that, well, just because the gays in the club have a degenerate lifestyle, who's to say that this is immoral? I mean, remember, you're in the Eros and Civilization, the polysexualism world. They had an intellectual intimidation behind them, whereas in the 50s, it was just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the intimidation worked the other way, and it kind of kept that particularly degenerate sexual behavior sequestered.
Yeah, there was it was ghettoized. If it's going to exist at all, that's how it should be treated.
And that's why, you know, when I think, you know, when you think about like Marcuse, how instrumental he was, and how he was really a bridge between Woodstock and the discotheque. You've got to look at him as a member of the Frankfurt School, and then, you know, you have to see, well, what does this really represent? What cultural perspective is being, you know, shown here? And I think I've read, you know, a couple times, you know, that it was Luchas in the Hungarian Soviet, mm-hmm. going all the way back into the 20s. He was the one that really began the polysexualism, anti-marriage sex education in Hungary before he was kicked out. And he also was bringing forward the concept of the fairy tale and fantasies, you know, kind of a Disneyland sort of thing. These things are all popping up in the 70s. You know, they're all coming to fruition. And so it's like you had said so clearly, and, you know, I still think it's something that everyone should be aware of and focus on, is that we're trying to build out a schematic. You know, we look at our culture today and it's just, you know, it's just degenerate. Well, how did we get here? We need to know that so we can make changes and you know, try to recover and try to repair the damage, try to build a future. And so we need to know, well, who was organizing the destruction? How did they do this? You know, and that's why, you know, the authoritarian personality, the Frankfurt School documents, MK Ultra, you know, these things are all related. They're all linked. And they all end up in our destruction and in the destruction of our culture. So the schematic helps build them out. And that's why, you know, these events, they may seem unrelated, but man, they are very, very important. And the last thing I wanted to say was just on the gold standard. You know, Tim, you're so right about that. When they got us off the gold standard, they created the potential for unlimited debt by the government. And this is what, of course, led to the wars and, you know, the militarization and all of the enormous expansion of government technology. If they hadn't gotten off of the gold standard, then America's gold and would have been drained, you know, in a matter of years. Mm-hmm. And then we would have been forced to try to replenish the gold or reduce spending, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once the gold standard was done away with, then the government debt expansion could begin. And like you also pointed out, the other part of that was the petrodollar. Is that, well, if you know, because the natural, you know, reaction to that is to say, well, the dollar doesn't have any value. But because the U.S. controlled the Middle East, they could insist that the only thing that you could purchase oil with was dollars, and thereby you actually created a, you know, a valuation that, unlike gold, which had a kind of scarcity at that time, as they look forward, there was an unlimited supply of oil. But it was always going to be needed and used for something. And so therefore, they created, to the same extent that oil, and when you looked into the future, was unlimited almost in the 70s. Or, you know, there was no time when it would stop being produced. There was so much of it. That their expansion of debt could go on indefinitely. And so now linking to this, of course, is the beginning of neoconservatism, right? Which kind of has its beginnings in the end of the 70s. You know, it kind of bobs and weaves a bit, but it, you know, you can kind of see it start to come forward in the 70s, where you would have constant intervention, that the philosophy of intervention, constant intervention, U.S. would become the world cop because we had infinite money, right? So we could take on something as costly as that.
Yeah, and if any country decided to go rogue and get outside the dollarized global economy, then they became an enemy that needed to be disciplined, or government needed to be toppled, and
couldn't buy oil.
Yeah, couldn't buy oil. So, and that's why even we see that today with China and Russia and these things, and they're trying to maneuver outside the dollar and these things. But yeah, the rise of neoconservatism is very interesting, because you kind of see that. I mean, we've talked about the sort of the WASP Jewish alliance, particularly, you know, with even going so far back to Palmerston and Great Britain and Zionism and these things. And there's a question of who was the junior partner, who was the senior partner in this relationship. But it seemed to be by the 1970s, particularly end of the decade, because you had the death of Nelson Rockefeller and John D. Rockefeller III, and sort of the decline of overt WASP power, and sort of the ascendancy of Jewish power. It became overt in the 1970s, and this also coincided with the development of the Holocaust mythos. That became the dominant theme or interpretation of the Second World War. That's a relatively new phenomenon, the 1970s, and that became very important. But after 73, yeah, the rise of neoconservatism, this also, you know, you have in the 1970s, you had these hearings, like the Rockefeller Commission and the Church Committee hearings, the Pike Commission on these abuses of the intelligence community, these limited hangouts. So we got some glimpse into what was going on. And, you know, Jimmy Carter becomes, of course, in between you have this Ford presidency, this odd man who was never elected. He got in because of Watergate, which seemed to be an intel operation against the Nixon administration. He was sort of maneuvered into that by one George H.W. Bush, who had deep intelligence connections. Nixon falls, and, of course, so does Spiro Agnew. And so Ford becomes vice president, then Nixon falls and Ford becomes president, and he picks Nelson Rockefeller as vice president. Then in the late summer of 1975, two women shoot at Ford. One is a Squeaky Fromm, a Manson acolyte, and the other one, I think, is Sarah Jane Moore, who had connections to the Hearst kidnappings. She's obsessed with the Hearst case, but she herself was an FBI informant. It's a really strange case. But of course, Ford survives and goes on to lose to Jimmy Carter in 1976. Carter sort of appears to be an outsider. At least that's how he's marketed. Of course, he was picked by David Rockefeller. He was a trilateralist. And trilateralism plays big into the decisions of 1973, the sort of deindustrialization and the gradual and the industrialization of China, which is beginning in the late 1970s and 80s. under Rockefeller auspices. But you have Carter kind of has this war with the CIA, and he fires Ted Shackley, or at least his CIA guy, Stan Turner, fires Ted Shackley. Shackley had eyes on being the director of the CIA, but then when Carter won the election, his dream of running the CIA was crushed. So he went into private industry and kind of started an private intelligence network. But in the late 70s, you had this thing called the Safari Club. And the Safari Club were a group of a bunch of spooks, international spooks from various countries. They got together and they said, because the CIA had been so hamstrung because of the committee hearings, they had to start a private intelligence network. And this plays rather loom. I think this looms rather large in the crisis of the late 1970s in the second oil shock, because as it turns out, it was the U.S. government sort of engineered the Shah's fall in the 1978, and it was the intelligence agencies that facilitated the rise of Khomeini. Of course, we think of Khomeini and the mullahs in Iran as being the enemy, but it looks like that crisis was created sort of as one thing to create another oil shock, and the second thing to undermine the Carter administration. Of course, what we have with the event you have with the Iranian Revolution, the rise of, you know, this theocracy, the mullahs come to power, and you have the seizure of the American embassy in November 1979. And that's brought about because Carter invites the Shah, the dethroned Shah in the United States. And he did that on the advice of Henry Kissinger. And what that did do is that created a situation. Once the Iranians seized the U.S. embassy, took those 52 hostages, held them for 444 days, that gave the pretext for the U.S. to seize Iranian assets, which were sitting in Chase Manhattan Bank.
Right.
Funny how that works out. And, of course, then they released Reagan's inauguration. That factors into the so-called, remember, this is the campaign of 1980, the October surprise issue, you know, controversy, where it appears that George H.W. Bush and Casey intervened to prolong the hostage crisis to facilitate Ronald Reagan's election in 1980.
Yep. So all that's right. Going. And so so there's so many details, it's kind of hard to get a grasp on all of them to get, just to kind of to spread them out so that people can see how, how it all works. But, what's interesting is that, like with neoconservatism, which is, I think it clearly starts in the 70s. I'm not sure if when it begins, it's quite as interventious, in its philosophy. But it could well be, because I really trace it like to William Crystal and the group that worked for Scoop Jackson.
The senator from Boeing.
that's right. And during his, and he was like running against McGovern, who was sort of, this non-intervention, kind of more isolated America that was focused on our social issues. But they didn't like that. And he had, Scoop Jackson had, if I recall, it was Doug Faith, Wolfowitz, and Richard Perle. And Bill Kristol helped them. So this was a Jewish cabal, I think is a fair way to describe. And they were trying to make the intellectual argument that isolationism was moral relativism. That we needed to get out in the world. And what was interesting is that if you actually go through the letters of these guys, you can see that they were simply, this whole intellectual kind of structure that they were trying to hoist it during this time was a facade, that really all they wanted to do was protect Israel.
Yeah.
You had the famous, very, illustrative letter that was found from Bill Kristol. And he said, that he was writing to a Jewish group, and he said, they were complaining about the cost of America's militarism. And he just hammered him, and he said, look, the reason that America needs a big military is because that's how Israel is going to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So to him, there was no question as to why the militarism and the philosophy of America intervening in everyone's business of what it really meant. He knew that the Middle East was, you know, going to attempt to, you know, regurgitate Israel, because they basically are trying to establish a nation in a, you know, in a, an area with, you know, 600 million Muslims that didn't have any recent historical connection into these areas. And it was going to be a, you know, basically a military process. You know, you're going to have to ram it down their throats. And so he could see it. You know, you had the Six-Day War, you know, the, Israel was obviously at risk. And so suddenly you have the neoconservative movement. And now what's interesting is that, I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of people are complaining that neoconservatism is basically just a, you know, kind of euphemism for Jewish. This is fascinating to me when you think about how it first tried to sell itself, you know, as a philosophy to American politic. Because it's now the case that people are recognizing that the neoconservatism, you know, is sort of focused, oddly enough, on Israel. I think the claim that it's anti-Semitic is, you know, not correct and overly broad. But the relationship between the neoconservative movement and the protection of Israel, and basically to a passionate degree, whereby America is seemingly in second position in terms of what's important, I think there's a very legitimate criticism of the current neoconservative movement. And so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, going forward, if they're going to be able to use the pejorative nature of the term anti-Semitism in combination with, you know, the Holocaust meme to keep neoconservatism in a position of dominance. Because right now, Tim, it comes from the 70s, but man, it's a disco dance that never stopped. I mean, we're just completely, you know, in the control of this political movement currently.
Yeah, yeah. They speak of the problems of dual loyalty, and I say, well, dual loyalty would be an improvement.
Yeah, well, it's true.
There's no dual loyalty.
There's no dual loyalty. What loyalty do they have to America? Is just a, you know, it's a, you know, the moral structure is, I think it's almost a distraction to even discuss it. I mean, really, it's much better just to keep the argument focused on the secret society. It dominated our culture post-World War II. You could see this with the creation of the CIA. You could see this with the MKUltra research. You could see this with the government links into the counterculture. You could see this with the manifestation of the authoritarian personality. The idea of, you know, that dual loyalty and I mean, all these things to me, these are just distractions. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically the real issue is just the secret society. Who is it? What is it? What do they want? And getting the people to know about this, you know, that's why when you come to neoconservatism, I mean, it's just another aspect of the secret society, right? That's all you're looking at. And like everything, it's camouflaged. It pretends to be this or that. It has, you know, people promoting it in the media as things it really isn't. But basically, it's all just part of control. And it's all done as a hidden agenda. You know, this is all something we're not really seeing the real reasons for anything.
Yeah, the bureaucracy, the machinery of state, the legacy media, television, radio, the news, print, these things have they're all coordinated to kind of confuse us, to, you know, sell us a bill of goods, to overwhelm us, to keep us confused in these things. And this is why you can't get a clear understanding of what's going on in the world, because obviously something as beneficial as like the Central Intelligence Agency or the National Security Agency to the secret society, the value is obvious, because now they have a specific bureaucracy machinery to carry out their plans. But if you just I mean, even a mainstream history of these organizations reveal the secret society.
Right.
Whether it's CIA, I mean, these things are all people coming from the world of banking and finance and these elite families that created these organizations CIA came from Wall Street and the city of London, and that's obvious with the OSS. OSS, you know, was organized under the tutelage of British intelligence. And so the links are there. It's just that they create a false story to justify it to the American people. For the organization, I was recently. I went to Mount Vernon for Christmas with my family, and this is how it's sold. And they have this, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. They have a really elaborate museum for George Washington, but it's interesting to walk through. They have videos and they have mannequins and displays, and you can see. So it's interesting. But they have one thing on a spy ring that operated during the Revolutionary War in the United States. I think it was the Culper Gang, I think is the name, if I got that right. But they're talking what they did, and some of the simplistic, at least relatively what it appears to be, intelligence operations, how they operated and how they dealt in espionage and had secret messages and these things, how they transported secret messages. But at the end of the film, it says that intelligence to this day remains vital to national security, and you see the emblem of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency. So, you know, so you're patriotic if you support these agencies of the cryptocracy, these criminal agencies. So that's see how it's sold. You're watching something on a revolution.
Did they have, representations of Washington's commitment to Freemasonry on display?
No, not much. If you look close, you can see some things like in the stained glass windows. You see like a pyramid and these things, so it's there. But there's no talk of Freemasonry. There's nothing like that.
That's interesting. Do they represent him as a Christian?
Yes, praying and things like that.
That is very interesting because I've actually read letters from Washington where he lampoons Christians.
Yes, his Christianity.
Talks about how stupid they are and how basically easy to fool. And of course, he was sworn in wearing his Masonic apron and, it was just a Masonic, ceremony. I mean, what?
And if I recall, his estate throughout the entire Revolutionary War period was left unmolested by the British. So,
yeah, how strange. The Revolutionary War. I mean, it's another one of these great holocausts that you start digging into it. I was at England a few years ago, and I mentioned this before. And I was at the Brighton Palace, and you could see this was all a personal residence of the father of the George who fought against Washington. And that George was, of course, a Mason, and his father. I mean, Tim, here there was no trying to hide the Freemasonic, allegiance that this George had. Every single wall, every piece of furniture, every black and white tile on the floor, everything was an homage to Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. It was completely the... the obsession of this guy's life. And that's why when you look at this struggle between the Georges later on, Washington and George, I think, what was it, the third? It sure looks artificial because you would think that a couple Lodge brothers could get together and if they really wanted to avoid killing a lot of people, find a way to do it. But oh no, they wiped out a big section of the population with the war. So, the 70s, of course, we were recovering from Vietnam. But I think the one of the things that's really tragic and sad about that decade is that was really the beginning of the current militarism. They brought about the salaried army, mm-hmm. right? Draft ended, and they decided they would get rid of that and just start to go to hiring people. And because the economic situation was going to get worse, we were going to outsource our whole manufacturing industry. The prospects for the people who were going to try to find work They were going to have to look to the military.
Yeah, fodder. Right? They'd be, well, fodder for empire. Yeah.
Yeah, they would just be the fodder for empire, just as always. It just seems to always happen. And so now, you know, 30 years, 40 years later, here we are, and we're all over the world, and, you know, we're dying every day. I mean, they've reduced, you know, now we're basically the world's dictator, except, you know, there's opposition from, you know, organized nations, like China and Russia seemingly are organizing.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in the Western world, the U.S. is now kind of a world dictator, and it all starts from here, you know, where you get rid of the gold standard, you're able to expand debt infinitely, you create an army that doesn't have any connection into moral order or direction. It's just basically a Praetorian Guard that'll do what it's told. The development of military technology, it all starts here. You know, this they had World War II as kind of an impulse, but this was really where the high-tech, you know, robots and the kind of weapons that were, you know, we're seeing now, it all comes from here. And so it's a good, you know, really good a decade for people to understand, you know, how it linked to the 60s, how it continued all of the same trends. There were new wrinkles brought to it, particularly the financial wrinkles. You know, you talk about the oil shocks. In my opinion, that was just done because oil had to be made more valuable, since it was going to be the basis for, you know, the dollar transactions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, if oil went from 25 cents at the gallon to over a dollar, it was a 400% increase. That was truly shocking. And they were able to do that by the artificial, you know, shortages. But when they created the, you know, what it was, it went from like $6 a barrel to $24 a barrel, something like that. That really created an incredible capacity for debt expansion, because when oil went up, the need for dollars exploded. You know, if you can only buy oil in dollars, and that was a military structure of the United States, then you'd better have lots of dollars available if your country, you know, is going to need oil for its energy industries. Well, the people who needed money to develop the technology that could be used to enslave a population, then suddenly they had just an unlimited credit card, Tim. You know, the Federal Reserve was now just going to be issuing debt, buying debt everywhere. And it led to the current situation that we have now, which hopefully will not last long, and there can be some resistance organized against it.
Yeah, and it appears to be some with China and Russia organizing some sort of a yuan base.
Yeah, they're you know, preparing for to swap out the dollar as the reserve currency. I think that is actually pretty clear.
And, ironically, it's the U.S. that has sort of expedited this because of their sanctions and these things that they've put on Russia. And
yeah,
the SWIFT, closing off of the SWIFT system and these things, so they're forcing the hand of some of these countries to develop an alternative system. Of course, we've seen the examples of Saddam Hussein, even Muammar Gaddafi, who have tried to step outside, at least suggested that, you know, maybe a gold dinar standard for Africa, these things. And and there's always been attempts to take out these other countries that look to develop these areas. Like, I think Gaddafi wanted a satellite and telecommunication system independent outside the West, and they don't want them developing their own resources and their own industry. That's one thing that the oil shocks did, was it retarded or development of the third world and threw them into debt, because that's when the IMF kicked in and started loaning the money to pay for the increased price of oil. And this set the stage for the debt crisis, which set the stage for neoliberalism, because with the huge debt, instead of just forgiving the debt, which a few people suggested forgiving, and they ended up dead or kidnapped and murdered, like that German banker, Herrhauser, I think was his name.
Right.
And you also, even way back in the early 60s, you had the guy Mattei, who ran Italy's national oil company, and instead of privatizing it to shares out to the Western oil companies, he actually ran it as a sovereign institution and started negotiating better deals with oil exporting countries because his plane crashes. That seems to be the pattern there. But the idea was the IMF was could step in with easy credit, and of course the collateral would be the resources, the infrastructure, and the blood, sweat, and tears of the people. And that's how it appears to have worked in Latin America and throughout Africa and these things.
And in Europe, too. I mean, look at Greece. Look at the pigs. You know, I mean, basically now all of their assets are on the block. Argentina is a good example. You know, the IMF debt comes in. They say, well, you're going to have accelerated economic activity, so you'll be able to handle the growth. The economic activity never accelerates. The debt sits there, and they go, we got to pay it back now. We're just going to take your country in exchange for it. And then bear in mind, well, where did the money come from that was given as a loan to this nation? Well, they just invented it. This was just central bank credit that no one had ever earned it. So basically, with a few strokes of a computer, they ended up owning a country. And then people sit there scratching their head and going, gee, I guess I'm a debt slave, but that's the morally right thing to do. I mean, wake up, people. You're just the victim of these clever financial,
It's you got to pay the money back, right? You borrowed it.
Right. you got it. You got it. Like a lot of the common people actually got to spend any of that money.
Yeah, I know. That's nothing. It's in the Swiss bank account.
It's just ridiculous. So you know, this is that. It's a cleverly designed slave system. It enslaves nations and the people inside them. Tim, we'll build out the schematic so people will be able to see exactly what happened one step at a time, and link our research to all of the hundreds and thousands of people that are out there now trying to, you know, expose this and trying to alert the public. Two phases to it. You know, we find data. We of course, you know, oftentimes we can only create plausible conjectures, but we are able to kind of construct a schematic. So that's the one phase. The other phase is just alerting the public to this, which everyone who listens to our shows and sees ideas that make sense can pass along, like our stocking stuffer concepts, you know, that get people talking about these things. We can't let people succumb to intimidation. You know, I know often I get accused of anti-Semitism because I keep going back to this connection I see between masonry and people who are Jews. The attack on me in this way is really, it doesn't move me, and I think people who are honest will see it's completely incoherent because, first of all, as we discuss it, we aren't ever trying to, you know, like talk about Jews in a general sense. What we have is a secret society. Inside the society, there are organizing principles.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't the whole Jewish race that's making these decisions. It's a group that somehow is able to maintain secrecy. And ethnicity is a very good conjecture. Mm-hmm. Right, because so many Jews involved in this, you could easily imagine that the secret society has a component that is a group of people whose Jewish ethnicity is part of how they're able to maintain the secrecy. Right, very simple to understand. Because think about the mafia. Right, this isn't an indictment of the Italian race. You know, when you point out that this organization uses ethnicity as part of omerta, right? Silence is maintained through, to some extent, the fact that they're ethnically connected. It's part of how they're able to do it. So, the people who are trying to hurl anti-Semitic, claim against me, I just find it to be preposterous. You know, it's just I don't even respond to it because it's simply a distraction. We've got to get to the bottom of the secret society. So it isn't just like the Jewish intellectuals, like the ones who were involved in the creation of the authoritarian personality or the Frankfurt School, are the many Jews in the Macy Conference and things. But it's also many like religious and economic theoreticians like Marx and Moses Hess, right? So there just seems to be...
And gangsters like Mo Dalitz and Meyer Lansky.
Yeah, not these guys, right? So you see, it seems like the European is kind of a sitting duck, and is easy prey, can't really defend himself, because when he tries to, you know, to do so, he's a claim that, well, it's anti-Semitism, right? Well, no, it's not. We're just trying to honestly get to, you know, an understanding of what is damaging our culture. Why is our culture basically crumbling?
Yeah, and I mean, you don't, if you point out Freemasonry and the British Empire, no one accuses us of hating British people.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like the you know, if you look at like Palmerston and you know, the group that was creating Zionism and the Irish potato famine, the Freemasons, man, the British hated those people. Mm-hmm. The real British people saw the Masonic control and the royal family as these palmy elitists who were basically only kept, you know, in their positions of power by military force. The people gave them no legitimate authority. Victoria, that just you know, cesspool of a leader. I mean, I think she was attempted to be assassinated like something like 13 times during her career. You know, the people hated her. So it wasn't an indictment. When they, again, it's, we're trying to understand the schematic. We want to know how it works, how it operates. And I would like the ones who want to go into this anti-Semitism stuff to actually stop and think for a little bit, particularly Jewish people. And say, wait a second, what if he's right? Right? Mm-hmm. What can we do to expose him? Because I think that righteous Jewish people, to use an expression, can be instrumental, Tim, in helping us build the schematic out. Because if it is, you know, organized as I see it, they would have much better connections into some of these, you know, ethnic centrifugal, you know, operations, right? Mm-hmm. They know these people. They would be trusted. They would get information, and they would do a better job of exposing it. So I'm really disappointed that there isn't more of this coming out of people who are Jews. And just like I'm very disappointed in people who are Masons. I was, you know, talking to someone who was a Freemason, and he was saying, yeah, you know, we can kind of see to some extent that up top, you know, there's, and I said, well, what the hell, man? You know, your responsibility is what, to the humanity, or to a few people who get you to swear oaths, right?
Yeah.
When you see evil, you've got to go after it. And so I would just say that to everyone. I would say that to the righteous Jews, it's up to you to get to go after those people who just because you have ethnic relations, if you see them in committing evil, you need to expose them. To Masons who are in lower levels, that you start seeing that you know, above there's mysterious evil, you know, swirling around, it's up to you to go and find out what the hell it is. Mm-hmm. And to Europeans, the same thing, right? You know, don't be intimidated by fear of these, you know, these groups, their power in the media, the fact they can throw a few names at you. What the hell? This is an all-hand work party. It's time for courage.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well said. Well said. Well, Joe, I think we covered it. You think the 70s?
Absolutely. By the 70s, I love that polyester look, and I think we put a good face on it.
We didn't talk about Jaws or Star Wars, but
No. Well, next show we'll get to them.
Okay. Listen, Joe. I'll talk to you later. We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much, brother. Yeah. We'll talk soon.
Enjoy the weekend. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye bye.